EC. Good evening and welcome to South Sudan in Focus on the Voice of America. I'm Carol Van Dam in Washington, and here are some of the stories making news across South Sudan and the region this Wednesday, December 20th, 2023. Authorities in Juba say serious Boda Boda accidents are out of control in the capital.
We are not happy with what we are seeing because there's nothing in our hand. We just help them in treatment and try to save their life. If the whole thing can be stopped, can be reduced, we are going to save a lot of innocent young South Sudanese.
And friends and relatives pay tribute to VOA Bureau Chief Charlton Doki, who died in a motorcycle crash.
He was committed and dedicated to the noble profession of journalism, of independent journalism.
May his family, and especially his children, find comfort in that noble name.
We'll have these stories and more coming up on South Sudan in Focus. Medical authorities say the high number of road accidents in Juba is shocking. Maker Isaac, medical director at Juba Teaching Hospital, says there are far too many motorcycle or Boda Boda accidents across the country, and he's calling on traffic authorities to enforce the law so that lives can be saved. Munyang David Mayar reports for VOA from Juba.
At a busy junction near Juba Teaching Hospital, motorcycle taxis or Boda Boda are bunched up, each carrying passengers anxious to reach their destination on time. But Isaac Makir, medical director at Juba Teaching Hospital, says many Boda Boda transport never reach their destination because they end up at the emergency room at his hospital with life-threatening injuries. Many are pronounced dead on arrival.
We are not happy with what we are seeing, because there's nothing in our hand. We just help them in treatment and try to save their life according to the injuries they have sustained. But if the whole thing can be stopped, can be reduced, we are going to save a lot of innocent young South Sudanese who can build the future of South Sudan. So we are seeing a lot of accidents, daily accidents.
Three, four, five.
The pages of the outpatient department register book at the hospital seen by VOA record between 5 to 10 traffic accident victims each day. Reverend Joseph Mori Lasu is one of the victims of a traffic road accident. He was admitted November 19th at Juba Teaching Hospital. He has been lying on a hospital bed with a broken leg after being knocked down by a speeding Boda Boda motorcycle. Lazu says many factors contribute to motorcycle accidents in Juba.
This motorcycle or Boda Boda, I see that they ride too fast. Some others ride it too fast because they do not have proper document, and when they reach a checkpoint, they speed up. Some others ride it too fast because of alcohol drinking, and others ride too fast because they want to show others that they bought a new motorcycle. I would like to call on Boda Boda to go slowly and know that there are other road users on the road.
Lazu says he has not been able to carry out his duties at his church or at home with his family for more than a month because he is bedridden at the hospital. 53-year-old Agostino Mutando, a Boda Boda driver in Juba, says road accidents usually happen unexpectedly, but he thinks when traffic laws are respected, road accidents will go down.
If you know the laws of South Sudan, you will not even have an accident. You keep your right, And if you are approaching a junction and if you wanted to negotiate a corner, then you apply the indicators either on the right hand side or the left hand side, and that is what we call double indicators. Double indicator shows that you are crossing the junction. It is only that in our country that laws are not implemented. As a rider, I know when you buy a boda-boda, something to protect you is a helmet.
Mutando says he has been observing the traffic laws since he started riding a motorcycle in 1988, which has helped him avoid accidents. First Lieutenant Ray Munray is a spokesperson for the South Sudan National Traffic Police in Juba. He acknowledges that road accidents involving boda-boda riders are common in Juba, but says police are doing all they can to enforce traffic laws to avoid serious accidents.
The traffic police will continue to enforce the traffic laws, but the responsibilities to stop traffic road accidents is shared responsibilities between the traffic police and the public. They should listen and respect the rules of traffic that we give. That way, we can be sure that the number of road accidents can be reduced each year.
While police struggle to enforce traffic laws, the tragedy of boda-boda accidents will continue to cause grief to relatives and friends of those killed in such accidents. Late last week, VOA Juba Bureau Chief Charlton Doki was killed when a motorcycle he was riding was hit by a boda-boda driver. His memorial service was held yesterday. For VOA News, I'm Anyang David Mayer in Juba.
Several South Sudanese journalists in South Sudan's capital, Juba, bid their final farewell to VOA Juba coordinator and assignment editor Charlton Doki yesterday. His body was flown to the Ugandan capital, Kampala, for burial near his mother and father. John Tanza describes the mood at the airport with Nabil Biagio before Doki's final journey to Uganda.
His body was brought at the airport at around 7:45 of local time here in Juba, and the custom clearance papers were all prepared, and by 8:30, we were all ready waiting for the plane to land, but the plane delayed, and it landed at around 10:05 a.m. local time, South Sudan, and we were very thankful to the airport authority who allowed six members of journalists representing several media houses in Juba town to be carrying his casket from the car onto the rail that takes it over into the plane. Normally, they don't allow people to go inside the Juba International Airport. Sometimes they would tell you, just put the casket on, the airport crew handle it, but we plead over them that this is a group of journalists who want to bid farewell to Charlton, who is going to be buried next to his mother and father who died in Uganda many years ago.
So airport authorities made an exception for this occasion. What was the mood at the airport among mourners?
The mood was very sad. The mood was very sad because they allowed six journalists and a sister, Charlton's sister, and then they allowed one of our colleagues, Irene Shepard, to be like the person coming from where Charlton was working and myself. So in total, there were eight journalists, Charlton's sister and an uncle, who were given a special permission to access the airport grounds where the plane parked, so that we could all bid our farewell to our departed colleague.
And I understand yesterday you had, the family had a requiem and you know, funeral service at the residence in Juba, and a large number of mourners turned up. Can you tell me about what transpired yesterday?
Yesterday was a very, you know, touching moment for some of us who were there at the funeral, at the memorial service. I mean, 100 of mourners gathered there, you know, government officials, VOA listeners, you know, dedicated listeners, and relatives of our departed colleague, both from the father and the mother, were there at the memorial service, part of the three, and went through up to like 6:37. And then there was a representative from the Union of Journalists of South Sudan who also made a remark during the memorial service, plus other, you know, members of Titan's family who are also government officials in Central Equatorial State. And then made a speech there. And his uncle also made very strong remarks appealing to the journalists in South Sudan to really work towards remembering Charlton Berkeley. And one message she was passing across is that the best way journalists of South Sudan to remember our departed colleague Charlton Berkeley is if they can fight the mess in the border industry.
And in terms of what is next, I understand the body has arrived in Entebbe, at Entebbe International Airport, where it will be taken to the final burial place. As I know, you've been with the family, mourning with them and talking to them. What is going to happen next until he's laid to rest?
What is happening next is after the family received the body this afternoon in the in Entebbe, Kampala, a vigil is scheduled at the late house in a suburb called Nakwero, Giaza, tonight. And then in the morning, they will depart for Bugerere tomorrow morning. And another vigil will be held at Bugerere tomorrow night. And then the burial is scheduled for Friday, tentatively at 2 p.m. Local time in Uganda.
Those are my colleagues, Nabil Biagio in Washington and John Tanza in Juba. As we said, hundreds of mourners gathered yesterday to attend Doki's memorial service in Juba. He was hit in a motorbike crash late last week. Michael J. Adler, the U.S. ambassador to South Sudan, told Doki's family members that their son was dedicated to professional journalism in the country. Nabil Biagio has more from Washington.
Journalists, friends, family, and dignitaries joined together at Charlton Doki's family home in Juba for funeral services and prayers before Doki's body was transported to Uganda for burial. Speaking at the event, U.S. Ambassador to South Sudan Michael J. Adler lauded Doki for his unwavering commitment to independent and professional journalism.
He was committed and dedicated to the noble profession of journalism, of independent journalism.
Mr. Tanza has called him a hero. May his family, and especially his children, find comfort in that noble name. And may his esteemed colleagues, fellow journalists, honor his memory through their commitment to continuing to tell the stories. May he rest in peace.
Helen Petia, deputy manager of the South Sudan Pension Fund and Doki's aunt, paid tribute to the journalist, likening him to a towering tree whose absence will be felt deeply by dedicated VOA listeners across the country.
The tree that bears fruit is broken. This is almost every morning we hear voices. Everybody in the whole of South Sudan hears about his son.
Petia urged authorities to enact stricter laws and regulations concerning road safety, emphasizing the need for enhanced protection for journalists and media houses in the country.
The government should put proper laws to protect the media people because the media are at a risk. In many occasions, people don't like the truth to be spoken. Protection of media houses or media or communication officers, it is a risk in South Sudan.
Doki's body has arrived in Uganda and is scheduled for burial alongside his late father who passed away in exile. For VOA News, I'm Nabil Biagio in Washington.
We will deeply miss our dear colleague, Charlton Doki. You are listening to South Sudan in Focus on the Voice of America. Coming up on South Sudan in Focus, tens of thousands of children will soon be born in Sudan and will likely have little to no medical care. Stay tuned.
What do you think? People speak out on important questions. The question today:
is there such a thing as unconditional love?
The reason why I say it's there, because I've seen my parents and I've seen there is unconditional love in their relationship. Basing on the way like my dad treats my mom, the love is unconditional.
No, I don't think that. It's very difficult to predict human beings. So human beings are just unpredictable. Anybody can change at any time. So that's why I believe there is no unconditional love.
I'm one of the people who believe in real love, and therefore I believe in unconditional love. It exists. It's there. It's been exercised among people. And we have the ability to give unconditional love. So it's there.
Honestly, I've not been there before, so I don't know much about it, but a lot of things that I've seen, people are struggling to love each other.
What do you think? A daily discussion of important questions from VOA.
You're listening to South Sudan in Focus on the Voice of America. In the Democratic Republic of Congo, voters have waited in line hours to vote in general elections today. Our Swahili service colleague Abudu Shakar Abud is in the DRC capital, Kinshasa, and earlier today he spoke with editor Kate Pound Dawson about what's been happening. They started by talking about the scene there in Kinshasa.
It's calm. The whole city is calm. The whole city is on vacation. Today it was an official holiday. But it's a chaotic scene at all polling stations. The polling stations have been chaotic. They have been open late, 2 to 3 hours late. I was also just informed that there was some stations were not open until 1 p.m. So that's really, really late. And that's what is happening in the city. The mood, of course, people are just confused. Why was it delayed? Why the Electoral Commission, CENI, was not prepared to be at this time? And if in Kinshasa the situation is like that, how about the rest of the country?
So you had talked about the problems in Kinshasa. What does that mean for voting in villages and Eastern DRC, where there's always a concern about security?
Well, the situation which is happening in Kinshasa is repeating itself in the whole country. Our stringer in Goma is reporting that at one refugee camp near the town where there was voting stations, refugees came and stole the material because they are not able to vote. So they said, we are taking this and going there. So there's an investigation going down there. In Equator, some people burnt electoral machines because they believed somebody from the government, a member of parliament, passed through the office before anybody else, and he was not supposed. So you have incidents which are small but can be significant in the outcome of the results. In many regions where there's no electricity, the machines have independent batteries, but they've discovered some of the batteries are not working properly. So you have a lot of issues taking place, and we don't know how the outcome is going to be.
Now, when do we expect the results?
The machine, which is so modern, we are told they can get results immediately. But now we are questioning ourselves. View the way they are working, view the way they have ill-prepared this thing. Will they be able to get all the results and be credible? But according to the Constitution, the Electoral Commission has until the end of the month to produce the results. So they have time, but we are expecting results to be known by the end of, I don't know if I can say today, because I don't know if the time will be extended, because we believe, most of observers and reporters, this cannot finish today. So we don't know what's going to happen, so we can't give you a deadline. When do we expect the results?
Oh, one quick question. You just said it might not end today. Is there a plan to possibly extend voting then?
Now, there comes a constitutional issue. There is no constitutional issue saying that the elections can go on the second day. I talked with a senior advisor of Tshisekedi, who was voting in one of the stations, And he said he's hoping that the CENI will extend until 7-8 until all the people vote. But the issue is here by 6 o'clock, it's dark. Many places we have seen in the voting is taking place in primary schools, which have no electricity. So they can't go on to the night. So there is all those infrastructure issue, which can be a challenge.
That is senior editor Abdu Shakar Aboud with VOA Swahili Service. He was speaking with my colleague Kate Pound-Donson from Kinshasa. Liberia's president-elect says he plans to declare his assets as part of the effort to weed out corruption. Joseph Boakai says he also plans to institute a measure to ensure transparency and accountability in his administration's fight to eliminate financial malfeasance and wrongdoing. This, he says, he plans to do by working with international partners to audit the government and the outgoing administration. His remarks came in an interview at VOA Studios here in Washington with VOA's Peter Clotie yesterday.
We start by making sure those people that we bring to cabinet are people of integrity. And secondly, want to make sure that even beginning with myself, we'll declare our assets and want to make sure that this is well known, the purpose of coming to government to know that it's public service. And if you are not ready to serve the public, you can go elsewhere. But we want to make sure that we start on a clear note that the people of our country stood on line, they protected the votes, not to bring a team again that will do the same thing that the other people are doing or worse. So it's a clear message, declare your asset, make sure that we are prepared to audit the outgoing government so that they tell us, tell the Liberian people of their stewardship, and to make sure that we start on a footing where people know that they come to serve the public and not themselves. If they don't understand that, they actually fall where it may.
Mr. President-elect, you talked about asset declaration starting from yourself and the people who work with you, as well as the outgoing administration. How do you plan to avoid the semblance of targeting people? Because some people will say these are politically motivated to tarnish their reputation or to go against them, people from certain tribes or specific parts of the country. How do you plan to avoid this?
We are aware of that. And when we talk about auditing, it's not going to be a Liberian auditing. We want to make sure that our international partners work with us for a public tender, for competent and renowned auditing firm that will be qualified at an international level to make sure they come on board to do that. We are aware of people saying wish hunting, wish hunting. But I don't think it's wish hunting when you have to account for your stewardship. But it has to be done in a way that is well-established entity with reputation to make sure that it audits and make sure that you report to the public the findings.
That was Liberia's president-elect, Joseph Boakai. He was speaking with my colleague Peter Clotie here in our Washington studios. The Electoral Commission of Liberia declared Boakai winner of last month's presidential runoff, defeating incumbent President George Weah. After winning a third presidential term, Egyptian President Abdel Fattah el-Sisi said Egyptians lined up to vote, not just to choose their president for the next term, but to express their rejection of what he calls the inhumane war in Gaza. He describes the war between Israel and Palestinian Islamist movement Hamas as Egypt's primary challenge. Ambassador Ayman Zine Aldin, former director of media at the Egyptian Foreign Ministry, tells VOA senior analyst Mohammed El-Shanawi that Egypt built an international alliance to support Palestinians' rights and will plan to formulate the basis for a final settlement of the conflict.
I've
been working with the Egyptian government for almost 40 years, and I'm quite familiar with the diplomatic powers that Egypt possesses, and I think Egypt is able to do that. In particular, I believe Egypt would be able to do that because this is not an Egyptian endeavor, even if the idea I offered in my article would be an Egyptian idea. The desire to work together to solve the Palestinian question and provide the Palestinians with the rights they deserve is a globally held desire. Many, many countries in the world want to see that happen. If you look at it from the West, there is this desire to see that the Palestinians get the right to self-determination. So this, it's actually an idea whose time more powerful than an idea that whose time has come. And I think this idea has broad support globally. So in terms of ability, I think Egypt is able. I think Egypt is already taking the lead in many activities in the United Nations and elsewhere to advance this matter. But I believe and I hope Egypt does more. Egypt can and should be doing more because a lot of work has to be done and Egypt is demanded to take a leading role in it.
You recommended that Egypt should exert an effort to create a new formula for the Palestinian national movement that would be able to rule Gaza after the war. Can you explain how and why?
Egypt should be there to support the Palestinians in rebuilding the structure for the Palestinian national movement as a whole. And this new structure should be in a better position to rule Gaza, but not just to rule Gaza, for the whole Palestinian national movement. I think this has been in discussion for some time, even before the October 7 war. The negotiations to reunite the Palestinian factions because of duplicity and confusion. So what I thought is something that needs to be done to continue on those efforts, but in a more fundamental way. Why I said that? Because I believe that the PLO was developed with the backing of Egypt in the 60s at the time of the big confrontation between the Arab world and Israel. The Palestinian Authority was built with Egypt's backing in the 90s, at the time of the Madrid Conference, the Oslo Accords, the peace process that envisioned within 5 years the building of a Palestinian state. I think the two structures, the PLO, the Palestinian Authority, were built in a different world than within which we live now. It's a different world altogether. The Palestinian society changed. We have new factions of the Palestinian national movement that are outside both structures, and the whole Palestinian national cause could be on the verge of taking different shapes and different momentum. This is why I suggested the idea, a new structure that will be able to represent Palestinian role in the world, how to bring together all factions of the Palestinian political movements, all factors, all elements of the Palestinian society, including the Palestinians who are citizens of Israel, and to define what is their objective, a two-state solution, maybe to become citizens of a single state, an idea that many people are talking about right now, or any other alternative. But it has to be a new, fresh structure, more relevant to the time. But it has to be a Palestinian exercise. The Palestinians are a resourceful people, very intelligent, very well educated, in the best position to know exactly what they need. But I think this is an idea whose time has come as well, and the Palestinians need to restructure the national movement.
So is Egypt on the move to play its role after the war or just on a waiting mode?
Of course, Egypt's mind is set on what's going to be happening after war. But the problem is that Israel is insisting on continuing the war for a long time in such a destructive and inhumane way. But I think Egypt should. And I won't be surprised if it is to some extent already working to develop its ideas on how to handle the future. Problem is, none of the parties in those discussions is now ready for those discussions, neither the Palestinian Authority, nor Hamas, nor the government of Israel. None of them is in a position to be engaged. I'm not sure if it is now putting as much effort as is necessary in it, if only because of the burning situation in the Gaza Strip.
That is Ayman Zain Eldin. He's former Egyptian ambassador to Spain, and he was speaking with my colleague Mohammed El-Shenawi. And that wraps it up for this Wednesday. We invite you to check out voaafrica.com for all your favorite programs and news updates. I'm your host, Carol Van Dam in Washington. On behalf of our engineer, Bill Andrade, and producer, Gwen Newton, thanks for tuning in. We'll see you back here tomorrow for another edition of South Sudan in Focus from The Voice of America.